Hello, welcome to another edition of The Debate. I'm Kovat Halfway. The nuclear disarmament meeting during the 68th United Nations General Assembly at the UN headquarters in New York is about global nuclear disarmaments, a sentiment echoed by Iran's president, where he called for a world free of nuclear weapons, including the Middle East. A tall order, especially in the case of countries in possession of nuclear warheads, like the United States and Russia, or ones who are undeclared, like Israel. On this debate, we'll discuss why previous calls for nuclear disarmament have not yielded the declared results and why the nuclear states continue to stick to their nuclear arsenal.
The UN member states hold fresh talks on nuclear weapons and the need for their elimination globally. The UN meeting opened with a speech by the world body's Secretary General. Following Ban Ki-moon's address, Iran's President Hassan Rouhani took the podium. Rouhani called for global nuclear disarmament on behalf of the non-aligned movement.
The non-aligned movement calls on all nuclear weapons states to ratify related protocols to all treaties establishing nuclear arms-free zones, withdraw any reservations or interpretive declarations incompatible with their object and purpose, and respect the denuclearization of these zones.
Rouhani also said any measure short of the total elimination of weapons of mass destruction would not be enough.
Thousands of nuclear weapons continue to pose the greatest threat to peace, and measures to de-target, de-alert, or reduce the number of nuclear weapons are not a substitute for their total elimination.
Elsewhere, the Iranian president called for efforts to push for a nuke-free Middle East. President Rouhani singled out Israel, saying the regime must come clean about its nuclear arsenal. Israel is believed to have hundreds of nuclear warheads. However, Tel Aviv has been pursuing a policy of nuclear ambiguity, refusing to admit whether it has nuclear weapons or not. Former U.S. President Jimmy Carter confirmed in 2008 that Israel had at least 150 nuclear warheads. Rouhani also said Israel is the only entity in the Middle East that has not signed the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, NPT. Iran's president says Israel must immediately join the treaty.
A lone B-29 was over Hiroshima.
Nuclear weapons have been used twice in warfare, and that was by the U.S. in the bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki in 1945. But thousands more remain in our world today, 90% of which are possessed by the U.S. and Russia. Their stockpile is enough to destroy the entire Earth many times over. The United States and Russia signed an arms reduction treaty in 2010. The treaty, called New START, imposed new limits on ready-to-use long-range nuclear weapons. Both countries will be limited to 1,550 ready-to-use long-range nuclear weapons. But arms control advocates have expressed disappointment in the treaty, saying it does not go far enough in reducing the dangerous weapons on both sides. This as numerous UN conferences on nuclear disarmament have failed to make them commit to disarming themselves to date. Nuclear weapons are the most dangerous weapons on Earth, and disarmament is the best protection against their dangers. But the reality is that nuclear disarmament has remained only an aspiration as nuclear states continue to stick to their deadly arsenal.
Well, let's find out why that is the case. Let me introduce our guest, former American intelligence linguist Scott Rickard joins us from Orlando, and we have senior fellow at the Hudson Institute, Richard Weitz, who joins us from Washington. Gentlemen, welcome. Scott Rickard, the speech of Iran's president, I don't know if you listened to it, was made at the UN. One of the statements, a world free of nuclear weapons, another call, reduction is not total elimination, and modernizing or upgrading does not move towards that goal. Just some of the statements that Iran's president Hassan Rouhani made. Isn't the U.S., as an example, in violation of the U.N. Charter then?
Well, the U.S. has been at a state of reducing nuclear arms for several decades. If you look at the work done originally under Jimmy Carter, when Rose Gotemeier actually negotiated the first strategic arms limitation talks with the Soviet Union, she also did the same under the work that she did with Barack Obama. But at the same time, these are just limitations. These are basically destroying and moving out older weaponry. I mean, I worked at Patrick Air Force Base, where they actually disarmed an unusable a Monument missile in front of the Air Force Tactical Air Command, AVTAC, where they're controlling a lot of the intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance. And that was part of the SALT I agreement under Carter, where they're basically destroying missiles that were even garbage sitting in front of buildings as particularly useless components. So it's more of a show when they're talking about reducing arms among superpowers, and it really has nothing to do with the actual imperialistic and militaristic attitude that the West, European, and British allies have done to the rest of the world. And it's kind of a joke. You know, Iran hasn't attacked anyone, and you don't have Iran even trying to develop nuclear weapons of mass destruction. And these are the kinds of attitudes that you have from militaristic individuals that are more interested and basically conquering other countries based upon economic means.
Richard Weiss, do you agree with that, especially the part that Scott Rickard talks about how this is just a show when it comes to the case of the United States, for example? We could put Russia in that category also.
Well, I think that Mr. Ritter correctly pointed out that the number of U.S. and Russian nuclear weapons has fallen dramatically from Cold War levels, whereas before, they had tens of thousands of nuclear warheads. Now they only have several thousand, and President Obama is committed to reducing those to zero.
Scott Rickard, let's move on to Israel now. Member of the IAEA, but not a signatory of the NPT, in possession of nuclear warheads, not to mention chemical weapons. Why hasn't the UN or the IAEA done anything about that? I mean, the IAEA is part of the UN. At least they could make enforcements there in order for Israel to become a signatory.
Well, the UN is not legitimate when it comes to dealing with the powers that actually control the UN. You know, you have the Security Council has been controlled for decades by the United States and their allies in NATO. They've basically vetoed any of the issues that have come up against any of their own countries, as well as Israel, that have obviously violated UN agreements. But unfortunately, they don't have to pay by the rules because they basically write the rules.
Well, Richard Weitz, let's move on to Syria. Just signed on to the Chemical Weapons Chemical Conventions Treaty for its chemical arsenal, which is supposed to be eventually destroyed under international inspection also. Why shouldn't Israel do the same, for example? I mean, Israel has used these white phosphorus bombs in 2008 war. And there's a lot of worry that based on what has happened with Syria and their willingness that the focus might turn on to Israel. But what's wrong with that?
Well, the specific case of the white phosphorus, those kind of non-lethal chemicals are disputed. The United States, for example, uses them to clear crowds in crossroads in Iraq, for example. I'm sure Mr. Ritter saw them in use, some kind of non-lethal chemicals to disperse crowds and so on. But more generally, I think that Israel might join the Chemical Weapons Convention. There's no need, Israel has really no need for chemical weapons. I'm not sure why they have not. I suppose it's related to the fact that neither Syria or Egypt did, but if both Syria and Egypt join, I would think that there wouldn't be any objections, since it's not Israel's defense would not rest on its chemical weapons capabilities.
Scott Rickard, you talked a little bit there about how you have Israel, who is not a signatory, of course we know that, but is threatening Iran, for example, and almost the countries who are part of the permanent members of the P5 plus one. They are also asking Iran to stop what they perceive to be a possible military dimension. Don't quite understand how that could be when they are all in possession of nuclear warheads, which in itself is illegal in the case of the U.S. when they say all options are on the table. I don't know how that works out. Maybe you can explain that for us.
Well, obviously, Israel will not give up their nuclear arms, nor will Pakistan or India. You know, this is not an approach that's going to work for any country. Unfortunately, there are chemical weapons that are being used on a daily basis. When you include depleted uranium, that is a nuclear chemical weapon that is poisoning the planet on a daily basis. And yes, Israel uses it, the United States uses it, France uses it, UK uses it, Pakistan has it, they haven't been using it. But the fact is that that weaponry was developed in the 70s, it's very poisonous, it causes incredible cancer across the areas where it's deployed, and that, my friend, is one of the worst treatments of chemical weaponry that the Americans have disposed upon the Middle East and Africa, and also throughout southern Europe in Bosnia and Herzegovina.
I hate to, Richard Weitz, just keep pointing on to the United States as many examples here that I'm indicating, but you know, I can't help it. They are, after all, the biggest possessor of nuclear warheads. Back in 2009, I'm sure you remember the speech that Obama made at Prague and some of the things that he said that he's going to do. Promises, reducing nuclear stockpiles, we know that, banning testing, halting fissile material production, preventing nuclear proliferation. I mean, some of the promises he made, he has not followed through with that. What international body should be monitoring this? Does the U.S. allow that? And why has this become not just President Obama's broken promise, but previous presidents also?
The Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, when it was negotiated, encompassed a series of bargains. One of the bargains was that the five countries that had tested nuclear weapons before the treaty was signed, which happened to be the five members of the permanent members of the Security Council, were allowed to keep those weapons that they already tested for a limited time period pending universal disarmament. In return, other countries were guaranteed that there wouldn't be any new nuclear powers, the major nuclear powers pledged assistance, and so on. For a long time during the Cold War, these pledges were ignored. Countries, strictly Soviet Union and United States, built up their nuclear weapons. But in the last couple of decades, since the end of the Cold War, these trends have been going all downward. You correctly mentioned President Obama's Prague speech of 2009. He reaffirmed those commitments most recently earlier this year. Some of them he's been able to keep. There's been no U.S. testing of nuclear weapons. Stockpiles have been going down. U.S. has been helping countries eliminate nuclear material, such as old nuclear reactors, which could be dangerous. Some of the goals, he said, preventing North Korea from developing nuclear weapons and having them, for example, he's not been able to achieve. But I wouldn't blame him. I blame the North Korean government for going ahead and testing nuclear weapons. They're the only country that's done so in the past two decades. So insofar as he's been able to, I think President Obama has kept his promises. In some cases, he hasn't been able to, but that's because the partners have not come through.
Scott Rickard, you're shaking your head.
No, that's extremely disingenuous. I mean, when you look at the kind of nuclear proliferation that the United States has basically changed, they've obviously gone to a much smaller arsenal, but it's a much more powerful arsenal. They don't talk a lot about the kind of arsenal that's available today. And the kind of arsenal they're talking about with North Korea is very rudimentary comparatively to the American arsenal. And you need to take into consideration that this whole control of nuclear proliferation has been a policy of the United States and its allies for quite some time. Mountain ranges in Libya have been blockaded from the Libyan government, even under Gaddafi, from being mined because it contained uranium. The reason the Americans go and help out with taking care of nuclear waste in many of these countries is also to protect it from getting into the wrong hands. So the protection around getting these nuclear bombs is obviously a very serious effort, but to deny countries that are sovereign, like North Korea and Iran, the availability of these kinds of weaponry to protect themselves from despotic nations like the United States, the UK, and France, who have attacked many countries in my lifetime and killed millions of people, whereby these countries have never attacked anyone. They only attacked the South Koreans under a sovereign disagreement that had nothing to do, that had more to do, and people like Richard Weitz should know, it had more to do with people like Dean Rusk and the administrations that were in charge in the United States in the early 1950s that were really against communism. because that was more war against Russia than it was against North Korea.
Mr. Weitz, I don't know about you, but you know, when we want to look at the situation with Syria, I don't recall at any point during my lifetime, and I want to reveal my age, that perhaps there was a possibility of the situation regarding Syria with Russia backing Syria and the United States going on its warpath recently, of two nuclear-armed countries that have the most nuclear warheads, that there might be an ounce of possibility for there to be a nuclear engagement in terms of an offensive from either, were the situation to go out of control. The threat of war is still there from the United States. Doesn't then the call by Iran's President Hassan Rouhani really should hit home, which is a sentiment by many people, a world free of nuclear weapons, especially in the Middle East?
I strongly disagree with the setup of the question. That I think what's very interesting is during the Cold War, as I do remember, and I can reveal my age if you want, we saw wars between the Arab states and Israel, 67, 73. During each of these conflicts, the U.S. and Soviet Union put their nuclear forces on alert. There were nuclear threats made implicitly and sometimes even more so. Of some kind of an exchange. It was a very, very dangerous world. This time, Russia has given no indication it would intervene militarily to defend Syria. There's no indication that the Russians would do anything other than protest and perhaps retaliate by selling weapons to Iran or so on, as President Putin hinted. There's just no, we're just in a different world here in which the danger of a nuclear war between the superpowers or the great powers is much smaller. The main concern now people have is of nuclear terrorism, that somehow some of these nuclear weapons, dangerous nuclear material, would leak out of the hands of governments, which tend to try and control the material, not use them, to some group that might decide it's in their interest to use it or to sell it for whatever reason.
That's a good point. We're going to get to that. But Scott Rickert, you were shaking your head again. If you have a reaction to Richard Weitz there.
Well, Richard Weitz does the typical thing. He provides an inadequate observation of the 1967 war. It was provoked by Israel on Egypt, and the Americans were ready to bomb Egypt with nuclear weapons. They actually loaded nuclear weapons on planes, on aircraft carriers, getting ready to participate in the war against Egypt. So this is extremely disingenuous when you take a man of his stature and he's spreading those kinds of, propaganda about the history. He's basically giving the old rhetoric around how the Arabs have caused a lot of the conflict in the region, when he knows very well that the Israelis did attack preemptively the Egyptians and did go directly at the entire region, and also sunk the USS Liberty deliberately during that particular altercation with the permission of Lyndon Baines Johnson.
We're going to take a quick time out right now. Let's listen to some of the viewer comments on the topic of this debate as posted on our Facebook page. Let's take a listen.
The U.S. has created a lot of enemies, hence they will never allow any nation to appear more powerful than them. They will keep on manufacturing more and more sophisticated military weapons just to make sure they maintain their power and make other nations appear powerless. Don't even dream about the U.N. disarming U.S. nuclear arsenals, because the U.N. itself is made up of the U.S.
Just one viewer comment there. Richard Weitz, you can take your pick of which one you want to put a reaction to. I mean, U.S. creating a lot of enemies, hence they're not going to allow any nation to appear more powerful than them. Does that require the U.S. Stance then regarding keeping their nuclear arsenal updated, upgraded, even though they get rid of some of their old nuclear material or warheads or what have you?
I concur with the first part of that statement. Second part, I disagree with. The first part is something that the President Obama's administration has tried to deal with. When Secretary Clinton came in, she said we need to make more friends and fewer enemies, and they've been striving to do that. With respect to the nuclear arsenal, it has been falling in terms of size. capabilities fairly constant. What has been happening is the U.S. and other countries have been developing much more effective conventional arms. So in the past, the kind of missions that you would assign a nuclear weapon to, you can now assign a conventional warhead to, because they're so accurate and they're so can be so successful at evading defenses and so on. So the militaries see nuclear weapons of decreasing, declining use. In fact, the only use I would see U.S. using nuclear weapons for now would be to prevent attack on itself in retaliation from nuclear attack in the United States, or, which is a bit more complicated, to defend an ally from a nuclear or major conventional attack.
I'd like to expand on that statement that Richard White's made there, Scott Rickert, about nuclear terrorism. I'm going to bring in the Syria example into the picture again. According to Russia, they have proof that insurgents actually have a form of sarin with them on the ground there. Now, we know that there has been lots of activity on the border there with Turkey, and in particular, Incirlik Air Base, which is known to have nuclear arsenal there of one kind or another, and that's in alliance with the United States. What if there was some type of nuclear terrorism to occur there with these insurgents? And that's just hypothetical, but therefore, this needs to stop. This nuclear weapons needs to be eliminated. That's just one example I'm using, but, you know, are we going to see any motions forward, or just a lot of just promises that'll be broken?
Well, obviously, there are promises that will be broken. You're looking at Iraq has tactical nuclear weapons that were there just as recent as a year ago. I have friends that were deployed there that worked at those facilities. So there are tactical nuclear weapons that are much smaller. They're much, like you said, more effective and far less destructive. You can actually drop a tactical nuclear weapon and it looks like a regular giant bomb. So these are the kinds of weaponry that have been developed in our lifetime that you need to take a close look at the kinds of ways that they're being deployed. Obviously, they've been at Incirlik for some time. You're looking at, for sure, there's a very simple, it's very simple to make sarin gas. Anybody with a master's degree can make sarin gas with very simple chemicals. So the fact that the rebels may have gotten access or provided access to sarin gas, these are not rebels. These are mercenaries for hire. They have been hired from all over the Middle East, whether from Pakistan, whether from Afghanistan, whether from Chechnya, whether from Dagestan. You know, these folks, many of them came from Libya. A lot of the people that were that left Libya went through Mali. You know, these are the warriors that the Americans have been funding to fight an illegal war against Syria. And certainly they've been given some type of weaponry, and somehow they've probably gotten some sarin gas as well.
Very well, we're going to leave it there. Thank you very much, former American intelligence linguist Scott Rickert there from Orlando, and senior fellow at the Hudson Institute, Richard White, spoke to us from Washington. I'd like to thank you for watching another edition of The Debate. Questions, comments, suggestions, do email it to us the old-fashioned way, newsroom@presstv.ir. From me and the entire team here in the capital, Tehran, it's goodbye.